Okay. Does everyone have the source sheets? Everyone has? Okay. As I said, I'm going to try to work on getting us tables for next week. There are no promises as to what the room setup will be. Show up and it'll be an adventure. Our topic this, and I hope that everybody got the follow-up email from last week and the email in advance of this class. In the event that you didn't get it, that means you weren't on the list, or it means that your spam blocker doesn't like receiving emails sent to large numbers of BCC people. If it's the latter, you can try whitelisting my email address and that may work. If you're not sure about whitelisting, talk to me after. Okay, so we talked about stress versus eustress last week, right? The idea that the stress is not defined as negative or positive so much by its nature and where it comes from as by the way we respond to it, the way that we perceive it. And studies have shown, both psychological studies and physiological studies, that when people respond to stress from a sense of, I can manage this, I am bigger than this, and it's actually going to help me, they do much better psychologically, they even do much better physiologically. So that's something to really think about. What I want to do this week is talk about addiction, and anytime I talk about addiction, I always lead with what you see in the first source on your sheet. For anyone who doesn't have the sheets, I have a pile of sheets here, but I'm going to put it over here so that people can get it without walking up to the front exactly. So anytime I talk about this, I always point out the organization that's listed in the first source, JAKS, a friend who is not familiar with it. They do remarkable work on addictions. They're here in our community. There are branches all around. I was involved with starting the branch in my community where I lived before coming here in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And it's a very good organization to be aware of. Hopefully one doesn't need it. But they're there. The cost of addiction doesn't really need a whole lot of introduction, and I think people know quite a bit about it. Unfortunately, it's constantly in the headlines. The opiates are the big ones in the headlines these days. Marijuana off and on, starting July 1, maybe back. But I want to focus more for our discussion on the issue of the power of addiction as recognized within Judaism and classic Jewish text, the fundamental problem that Judaism has with addiction, such that, now I'm going to turn this to the side because it's giving me feedback. Now it's giving more feedback. Okay. If someone really can't hear me, let me know. Where is the off button? Sorry? Okay. Here we go. Much better. Okay. So now, if anyone can't hear though, really seriously, let me know and I'll fix it. What I want to do is talk about how addiction is registered in Jewish text, the fundamental philosophical problem that Judaism has with addiction, and I'll explain that when we get to it, and then talk about some of the similarities between ideas found in the classic 12 steps of the various anonymous groups and that Judaism has within its own teachings. I think that there are some very strong and fascinating similarities and helpful similarities between them. That's basically where I want to go with it. But I wanted to start with a story that's recorded from Dr. Abraham Tversky. For those who are not familiar with him, he's written 60-something books on primarily issues of addiction, issues of self-esteem and self-image. He is fantastic. He is a rabbi. I first heard him speak live at a rabbinic conference. It was, I think, 1998, 1999. He was talking about rabbinic burnout. And it was fascinating, just really beautiful and brilliant. He founded the Gateway Rehabilitation Center in Pittsburgh in the late 1970s and has won numerous awards for his work. Really very worth reading. And he has a book called Without a Job, Who Am I? And obviously it sounds like dealing with unemployment as the issue, but take a look at this story that he tells here, because I think it really speaks to not only the cost of addiction, but the psychological causes of addiction. Sybil was admitted for heroin addiction. She was a registered nurse who had not worked for 6 years because of her addiction. The reason she came for help was that she had used up all her veins and had none left for injecting heroin. In the first interview, I noticed that she was wearing a locket. "Is that real gold?" I asked. When she answered in the affirmative, I asked, "How come you still have it and did not sell it to get heroin?" "I'll never sell this," she said. "This was my mother's." "Let me see it, please," I said. Sybil handed me the locket, and I took the scissors lying on the desk and made as though I was going to scratch the locket. "What are you doing?" Sybil said. I said, "Don't get upset. I'm just going to scratch it up a bit." "But that's mine," Sybil said. "I promise I'll give it back to you," I said. "But I don't want it scratched up," Sybil said. "It is beautiful and very valuable to me." I said, "So if something is beautiful and very valuable, you don't let it get damaged, right?" I took Sybil's arms, which were marked by the unsightly tracks and scars of abscesses. "Can you read what that says?" I asked. "It says, I am not beautiful. I am not valuable." And tearfully, Sybil said, "I never thought I was any good." Sybil recovered from her drug addiction and became very active in helping other nurses with drug problems. She discovered that she had a desire to help others. Now Sybil knew who she was. It's a remarkable story on many levels. There are a lot of lessons, I think, that should be gleaned from it. This is actually, I think, the third or fourth different setting that I've used this story in with different messages, because there are so many different pieces to the story. But here, what I want to show here, and it's going to fit into what we're going to discuss, is the problem of the psychological link. The link between one's own psychology, what's going on in our minds, and what happens in a case of addiction, how one's mindset can actually contribute to a problem of addiction. So I have the first question I have to ask before we're going to show those psychological connections is, fundamentally, can you define addiction? As opposed to, let's say, dependency. Okay, Susan and I had this conversation yesterday, so I'm going to ask Susan to wait 1 minute. Loss of control. Loss of control. Okay. What else? Yeah, Dahlia.
Can't live without it.
Can't live without it. Okay, that's stronger than loss of control now. Okay, Susan.
Commit a crime in order to keep your habit going. You don't care about anything else. And you can't stay at the dose you're given. You must keep adding and adding to it because otherwise, you're dependent.
Interesting.
That's a big difference that people don't realize the difference.
Okay, so two elements that Susan mentions. Number one, willing to do anything in order to feed the habit. And number two, needing to increase what one is receiving in order to find satisfaction. Rhoda.
Using something, knowing the consequences and doing it anyways.
Knowing the consequences and doing it anyways may be symptomatic of addiction. Okay. Sharon.
Having the need for something that is bad.
You need it even though you know it's bad for you, right? And that speaks to the disconnect in terms of use and knowing that you're doing damage, but using it anyway. Moja.
How about something like the inability to control your type and your desires such that it reaches a point of repetitive action?
The inability to control the desire that leads to wanting whatever it is, such that you now create the habit of ongoing need. Okay, all of these things are good. I think one key point that has to be stressed is the distinction between dependency and addiction, because a lot of this is about dependency, and addiction is not simply a stronger form of dependency, but you've actually gone over into something new in terms of the way it is manifest. The fact that, as Susan said, you need more. The fact that somebody is willing to engage in violence in order to get what they want. These things mark sort of a new creature. Rita, and then I'm going to go further with this. Yeah?
People become addicted to something, they feel this is the way to deal with their pain. For example, they'll have one drink and they feel better. And so they become addicted. The alcohol becomes the option to deal with their pain.
Good. So, right. So Rita makes a point, which is a perfect segue into my next question. I was going to ask, what causes addiction? So Rita suggests that there's pain that leads people to seek some kind of comfort, some kind of satisfaction, and that's what they're going for when they look for whatever it is that they're feeding their addiction with. Yeah.
You start off in a social situation. I don't know if anybody here remembers the days of Wine and Roses, where she became an alcoholic when her husband was an alcoholic, but she was chemically addicted and he could get off. There's two different kinds where you socially start and you can't stop because your body quickly adapts to it. And the other is to hide the pain or to not allow yourself. And once you start, you think you want to get off. You don't think, you think you've got control, but you don't.
Good. Yes?
To experience pleasure.
To experience pleasure.
I think a lot about pain, but I think a lot of addiction is about getting that high, getting that. I'm not talking about the root cause,
yeah.
But the dependency comes on the high.
Right. In other words, there has to be a receipt of something in order to trigger the addiction. But let me ask the question. Is that pleasure required in order to continue the addictive behavior?
No.
See, one of the things that you find when you're dealing with addiction is that sometimes, in the beginning, they'll do this because it brings them pleasure, but they'll keep on doing it even though the pleasure isn't there. It's like the commercial on the radio that they had. They were running on 680 for a while about the gambling addiction. Right, you heard that one where there's somebody playing the slots and all the noise and the fun is in the background and then gradually it disappears but they're still gambling. Because that's just that's what's now the ingrained addiction, even when that which had led to it isn't there anymore. Yes.
Isn't the basis
physiological? That's good. No one's mentioned it yet, but I think it's a very important point, is that there's a distinction we're going to have to draw between psychological and biological. And so I'm going to come back to that. It's an important point. Thank you. Yes?
I think one of the things, I worked in addictions in Vancouver, and one of the things we noticed there, especially for people who were engaged in heart or heroin use, is that there's a culture and a friendship and community. And so a lot of my clients would say it wasn't that they weren't getting high anymore. They were just hurting baseline, feeling okay, not sick.
Right.
But it was the whole culture. So when you say to someone, they might say, I know this is bad, I'm going to stop. But the ritual, every morning they would wake up, they did the same things, the same friend, the same people. Just asking someone to stop the thing that's making them sick, if you might have an awareness. But you're asking them to give up their community, their culture, their friends, their perhaps the only family they have.
Right.
Sometimes you forget that. It's a big loss.
Right, right. There are many contributing factors, and that's certainly a key one. Very much agreed. Gary?
It's building the need to function. And in order to build the need to perform
whatever job they have, you have to think it, raise the basis. So a person may be led into this because it enables them to function. Right, that's what you're saying, on an ongoing basis. Right. Right. Good. So all of these, I think, are accurate elements of it. I'm going to take Ian, and then I'm going to go a little further. Yeah.
The feeding of any compulsive need.
The feeding of a compulsive need. Interesting. Next week, we're going to talk about OCD. So I'm going to hold that thought in terms of compulsions, because we have to do some work to define what a compulsion is. But it's definitely an important point. Yeah. Actually, I said I was going to go further, so I am going to go further. Muhammad, you'll tell me after. Yeah. I want to show you two definitions. I found many, many definitions, unsurprisingly. But these two highlight two different aspects. First one comes from CAMH, right here in Toronto, Center for Addiction and Mental Health. And this speaks to the, well, you'll see. Experiencing enjoyment or going through withdrawal do not in themselves mean a person has an addiction. The fact that you enjoy something doesn't mean you're addicted to it. The fact that when you don't have it, you're sad or you feel something is missing doesn't mean that you're in a state of addiction. Because the term addiction is commonly used in such a vague way, there have been many attempts to define it more clearly. One simple way of describing addiction is the presence of the four C's. In the original, the C's are bolded, but when I printed this off the PDF, the C's aren't so bold. But there are four C's. We can look for them. Craving, loss of control of amount or frequency of use, compulsion to use, and use despite consequences. Craving, there's desire. When I don't have it, I want it. Loss of control of amount or frequency of use. So, you know, if you're dealing with a substance, just saying, I need more of this, and as much as is available, that's what I'm going to use, and then I'm going to go looking for more. You can't say, I'm going to stop at whatever. Compulsion to use. Compulsion is stronger than just that there is a craving. There is a sense that I have to have this, and if I don't get it, there are going to be negative consequences. That's a big thing, the issue of compulsion. And then finally, use despite consequences. The person thinks, if I don't use it, there are going to be consequences, and they ignore the fact that when they do use it, there are negative consequences. They're losing their job because of their drug use, but they're going to keep on doing it anyway. That will be one example of many that could be brought. So I find this to be a very useful definition. It speaks to the desire. It speaks to the lack of control. It speaks to the fear of what if I don't get it, and the insistence on continuing despite the fact that you can see it's harming. Those are, I find that to be a helpful, useful definition. The other definition I brought here, source number 4, comes from a website called Psychology Today. What is addiction? And I like it because it speaks to the fact that there is the psychological side, but there also is the biological side to it. The word addiction, in source number 4, is used in several different ways. One definition describes physical addiction. This is a biological state in which the body adapts to the presence of a drug so that drug no longer has the same effect, otherwise known as a tolerance. One is now tolerant of whatever the dose is of that drug. Another form of physical addiction is the phenomenon of overreaction by the brain to drugs or to cues associated with the drugs. An alcoholic walking into a bar, for instance, will feel an extra pull to have a drink because of these cues. These are things which are physically based, a biological state, as is noted here. I don't intend to spend time really on the biological issue in this hour, because it's really a whole other discussion, and as important as it is, we have an hour. It continues, though, to say, however, most addictive behavior is not related to either physical tolerance or exposure to cues. People commonly use drugs, gamble, or shop compulsively in reaction to being stressed, whether or not they have a physical addiction. Since these psychologically based addictions are not based on drug or brain effects, they can account for why people frequently switch addictive actions from one drug to a completely different kind of drug, or even to a non-drug behavior. Right? You follow what he's saying? It's a really important point. Addiction sometimes is purely biological. However, if you can see that somebody has an addictive behavior and then switches to another kind of addiction, that tells you something. It's not about the drug. It's not about the fill-in-the-blank that you're dealing with. There's something else that's the problem, as the piece continues here. The focus of the addiction isn't what matters. It's the need to take action under certain kinds of, as we said last week, stress. Treating this kind of addiction requires an understanding of how it works psychologically. This is what we want to talk about. Now, it could be argued, and it has been, that this concern for addiction is recognized primarily in modern times. However, as I'm going to show you, there's a concern for this in the Torah going back to the beginning. And the case I want to talk about is the case that's called in Hebrew the Ben Sorer Umoreh, also known as the stubborn and rebellious child. I don't mean your kids. That's not what I'm talking about. I don't mean my kids. This is a case that is described in the Torah that is extreme, and as the Talmud states, never happened, never will happen, wasn't meant to happen, but it's meant to teach lessons. Take a look, please, at source number 5. This is the passage from the book of Devarim of Deuteronomy, where this is described. When a man has a son who is stubborn and rebellious, he does not listen to the voice of his father and the voice of his mother, and they rebuke him, but he does not listen to them. His father and mother shall take him and bring him out to the elders of his city and the gate of his place. And they shall say to the elders of his city, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He does not listen to our voice. He is gluttonous and a drunkard." And the entire population of the town shall stone him with stones, and he shall die. And you shall eradicate evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Wow. Right, so what is the lesson here? Parenting advice. What is the lesson here? First, I just want to show you source number 6, because you can't read number 5 without number 6. This is the Talmud's observation. It asks a question. Because this person ate a tartimar of meat and drank half a log of Italian wine, these are measures, tartimar and log, just because somebody ate this and drank that, his father and mother will take him out to stone him? Rather, it never was and it never will be. This is not to be carried out. And as a matter of fact, the Talmud has all sorts of analyses of the verses themselves to demonstrate that even the requirements of the law cannot be satisfied. This circumstance physically cannot happen, and it's a whole range of analyses that aren't germane for our discussion right now. But the Talmud then asks, so why is it here? Right? Was God paid by the word? You need to add text to the Torah. Why is it recorded? Learn it and receive reward. There's something to be learned from this passage, multiple things perhaps, and we'll get a reward for it. One classic approach was from the Maharsha. The Maharsha, Rabbi Shmuel Edels, wrote in 17th century Poland. And he said something that you will recognize immediately. He said, this is meant to teach lessons about discipline. Our children are undisciplined, they don't listen to us, they run around wild in the streets, and this is to teach parents that you must take charge of your children and scold them and instruct them and so forth. No, not kill them. He wasn't proposing that. But he said it means take the education of your children more seriously than we are today in 17th century Poland. What is old is new. What is new is old. That was his response to it. Quite frankly, I actually see the opposite. I see the opposite in terms of what's needed. Meaning, what have the parents done so far before they take him out to the court? They rebuke him, he doesn't listen to them, right? In other words, they've tried the rebuke.
But he did it more than once, and I assume that he would forget it.
Right, the assumption here is that it's more than once. And the statement is that there is indeed a problem, and it's not a problem that rebuking is necessarily going to solve. Lynette, you've been waiting. I'm going to repeat it.
And then the third level of review is in fact the jury, or the people who participate in the sentence. So I think what it speaks to is the importance of hierarchy number one. And I think the other thing is responsibility for the person who's speaking for some good. Clearly, all three have responsibility: parents, the elders, and the community. So again, I think that's what you speak about the person.
Right.
Community, we all bear
Right, so Nanette points out two things you can learn here. One is the element of hierarchy, going from the involvement of the parents to the court to the community at large. And then the other, beyond the hierarchy of their participation, is the fact that there's responsibility on all three levels to deal with this kind of a situation, and hopefully I would expect that would mean to forestall this kind of a situation before they end up in this position. Rita. Then that could be. I mean, it's not, in this story, we're not getting here, and this is a general rule for when you try to deduce lessons from the Torah. You're not getting a full discussion here. We don't know the history of the family in order to know everything that's going on. We're getting something very direct and localized. Marlene, you had a hand up, or, no? Okay. Yes. Right. Right. We don't know. Well, there's a lot, as I said, we don't know about this story. But we don't know, are they listening to what the child's situation is? Also, the word used in the Hebrew for rebuke here is a harsh word. The word in Hebrew is v'siru oto. Liaser, right, that form, can mean to scold. It can frankly refer to physical, you know, corporal punishment as well. It's the same word that becomes the basis for the word musar, which is a word that has many different levels to it. And I'm not going to go into that now, but it's something we may have to come back to at some point. But what we're seeing here in this passage is that it's not meant to be implemented, but what's on the books is to end the life of this individual who is eating meat and drinking wine and not listening to his parents. Well, that's difficult. We have a general concept, one second, we have a general concept in Judaism that corporal punishment, not corporal, capital punishment, is reserved for crimes of the highest order. And while I may think failure to listen to your parents is a crime of the highest order, generally speaking, that's not described that way in the Torah. He ate too much meat, he drank too much wine, and from this? Like, what is going on that there should be such a penalty? Ruth, and then I'm going to go further. Yeah.
Just the excessiveness that is being targeted here, I think.
Because it's excessive? Okay. But then, you know, there are other ways to deal with people who are gluttonous and people who are drunk.
I'm trying to tell them they have enormous number of fences built around so that there would never be a situation where the kid was taken up and stoned.
Right. That's true. But I it's hard to relate to something that says excessive, you know, like isn't there a severe penalty in Singapore for like chewing gum in public, right? But I'm pretty sure it's not capital punishment. Right? Is that true? It's not capital punishment, right? What is it that's going on here? So take a look at source number 7. The Talmud deduces the laws of this Ben Sorer Moreh, this rebellious son, from the verses themselves. I didn't bring you the deductions, just the method by which it's drawn from the verses, just the conclusions. Source number 7, he is only liable when he purchases cheap meat and eats it, and purchases cheap wine and drinks it. We're talking about somebody, it is kosher. It's cheap meat and it's kosher. So that's another reason this story can't happen. He makes sure what he's getting is stuff that's inexpensive. He's getting the meat that's inexpensive. He's getting the wine that's inexpensive. This isn't somebody who's indulging in luxury. This is someone who's trying to feed a habit. And if you take a look at source number 8, it makes it even more clear, because we're talking about someone who does not have resources of his own. He's getting the money by stealing it, but specifically from his parents. If he steals from his parents, and he eats in his parents' property, so he's eating in the yard or in the house, then even though the money is available, he's afraid. And therefore, this law won't apply to him. It can't be somebody who is operating in fear. So if he's eating in the property, he's not in this category. If he steals from others and eats in others' property, then even though he's not afraid, meaning he's not afraid when he's eating because he's not afraid of other people catching him, it's his parents he's afraid of, it is not available. Still, the resources aren't there. He can't get that money easily. He can't get the food easily because he's getting it off of other people. And certainly if he steals from others and eats in his parents' property, so it's not readily available, he's getting it from others, and he's afraid of getting caught, then it's also not relevant. When does this law apply? Only if he steals from his parents, so that it's readily available, and he eats in others' property, and therefore he's not afraid of getting caught. This is somebody who is looking to take whatever he can get, has it at hand, right? Has it at hand, and is not, there's nothing to inhibit him from continuing this. And the Talmud states regarding this, source number 9, and this is the key line, it asks the question that we asked in number 6, but now we're not addressing the parents. Now we're addressing the Torah. And asking, because this person ate a tartimar of meat and drank half a loaf of Italian wine, the Torah says he should go to the court to be stoned? Forget the parents. How could the Torah say it? Rather, the Torah realized the end of the stubborn and rebellious son's path. In the end, he's going to finish his parents' property and seek to feed his habit. And he won't find it. He'll go out to a fork in the road and steal from people. And the Torah said, let him die innocent and not die guilty. Their concern is that when he reaches a certain stage, having fed his addiction through what was available, and when there was nothing to inhibit him from doing it, the result is going to be that he will ultimately need to feed this habit, and he's going to become a bandit. And he's going to steal from people at large, and ultimately that means he's going to go out and kill somebody in order to be able to feed the habit. It goes back to what Susan had said when we were defining addiction in the first place. He'll do anything in order to get what he needs. One of the key distinctions between a dependency and an addiction is that he's willing to go that route. And what the Talmud is saying here is, when we want to teach you a lesson about addiction, to say that if someone goes down this road, you have to realize just how far things can go, just how serious things can become, and know that, and it words it in terms of a capital punishment it never intends to carry out, as stated here in the Talmud, in order to teach, know how serious this is. Right now, it's a kid who's acting out, eating too much, drinking too much, but don't think that you can minimize it, because where it's going is fatal. That's the idea. Susan and then Gary.
When you're on the drug, and when you're on continuously after a long period of time, you are not aware of how the drug is affecting your brain.
Right.
You think you know.
Right.
The drug takes over your mind.
Yep.
And then you're not in control of your actions, because the drug is in control of your actions.
Right.
Much more so. And it's not that you're innocent.
Right, and that's actually something that always troubles me with this passage, which is, and I'm less troubled because, again, it's not meant to be implemented, but fundamentally, does the Talmud recognize the lack of control involved in this situation if you're sentencing this kid to death? On the one hand, it seems fairly clear. It doesn't recognize the lack of control because here we are, we're putting him to death. Unless it's trying to say, we recognize he's not under control, but we still need to protect society. And we're going to do it at his expense, which would be the other way to read it. Gary. It's a volume measure. It's a dry volume measure. Some amount of meat. How much is it in our terms? I don't know. Marilyn.
Because if he keeps eating that way and they're using food,
yes. That's one way to look at it. That's one way to look at it. Marlene, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And apparently that's more common than we realize.
Yep.
So I just thought,
Right, Marlene points out that it is, unfortunately, quite common, and every once in a while there are public service announcements about it, that kids get into their parents' or grandparents' medications, and it starts them on that path. And this is, yes, this is a common phenomenon, and it's one that people have to be aware of. Yeah?
I think there's something might be missing from the story. Just it's probably have to abbreviate it, but
yeah.
It's suggesting that his crawl or cry or whatever you want to call it in this passage relates to the female eating in a gluttonous state and overdrinking and all this, but it doesn't talk about anything else in his life. So what we're missing is if someone a good person otherwise, let's say he was a learned person and he was teaching other people or whatever,
yeah,
doing some goodness in his life, it should mitigate this story. But, so we don't know anything else about
right.
The person's life. And that's a problem for me because I think it's hard to understand
right.
What the lesson we're talking about today
right.
If we don't know.
Right. So two notes. One, nothing's abbreviated here. That's exactly the way it's presented in the Torah. But number two, and I think speaking to your point, because this is meant as a parable for instruction, as opposed to a law to be implemented, it's one-dimensional in that regard. It doesn't give us what you would see if this were an actual court case, where there would be any sort of additional discussion. I could make the argument that if he's a threat to society, I don't care about what else he's done, right? I mean, I don't know if anyone here follows college football, but a few years ago, Joe Paterno at Penn State, right, allows one of his staff people to be a predator. Joe Paterno gave a lot of money for education of others, right, was an upstanding human being in terms of training generations of football players to be good human beings, and he was. But he allowed this to go on under his watch.
Well, let me just follow up then, because I don't know if you can get to it today, but the follow-up from the parable.
Yeah.
Is that society today is obviously more advanced, I'm not saying it's great, but it's more advanced in terms of addressing mental health issues. And we need a lot more work on that, I understand, but that's what the solution is to the problems we're talking about.
Right. No, I don't think there's anything here that disagrees with it. I think that may be the message that you're supposed to draw. When it's saying to you, this rises to the level of a capital crime, what it's trying to say to you is, and take it seriously at this stage. Address it in whatever the means are that we have of addressing such things. The Talmud is telling me it's not meant to be addressed by a court killing him. But it's going to have to be addressed. I'm going to move on with this. Everyone is making important points, and I know there are more hands, but there's so much more to discuss here that I want to move forward. Because of this recognition, which goes back to biblical times, of the danger that comes through through addictive behavior, you find prohibitions against any activity that could lead in the direction of addiction. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein in 1974 was asked about use of marijuana by yeshiva students. And he came out with a very clear response saying it is prohibited, and he gave all sorts of reasons why it is prohibited, and this is one of them, what I translated for you in source number 10. He says, further, he, the drug user, causes himself great desire, greater than the desire for food and similar desires for life necessities. Some such people cannot reduce and eliminate their desire. This is a serious prohibition. For the Torah states regarding the stubborn and rebellious child, regarding the exceptionally great desire he has for eating, even though it's for kosher food. And certainly to bring upon oneself an even greater desire, and for something which is not a necessity, right? He's taking something in that he doesn't need. He creates a necessity for himself. He says this is prohibited, and therefore he says outright that that drug use is off limits. Why is alcohol allowed in Judaism? That's a great discussion, but we don't have time for it right now. And it's not simple and straightforward.
What about cigarettes?
Cigarettes, the same question. I mean, cigarettes, at this point have been prohibited by almost all responsible authorities. The alcohol situation is much more complicated, but again, it's really beyond the scope of what we're going to get to right now. Brenda, and then I'm going to move forward because I really do have to get forward.
I understand this very, very clearly because I had an employee who said to me, I can't have one beer.
Yeah.
If I have one, I have 12.
Right.
And that's because people have addictive personalities, so therefore the marijuana shouldn't be started because people do have that personality.
Right. And there's more to be said about that, both in terms of the psychological and in terms of the biological. Meaning sometimes people will have a predisposition for it. A certain percentage of society has that predisposition, aside from the level of psychological need. Take a look at source number 11. I like this one because it's very simple and short and straightforward. Rabbi Ben Sion Mutsafi answers questions on a website. Question put to him, what is the Torah's view of smoking soft drugs, parentheses, hashish? Answer, any addictive food, drink, or substance is prohibited. Beginning, middle, and end. So what this is about, and what he's, and the reason why Rabbi Feinstein says this, and Rabbi Mutsafi says this, is actually, I think, fundamental to Judaism. It isn't only about this is bad for you. It's about a philosophical issue within Judaism. And here I'm going to make a longer story short because I want to get to the last part of what we're doing. One of the most fundamental tenets of Judaism, according to Maimonides, maybe the most fundamental tenet of Judaism for the Jew, is free will. The idea that you determine how you will react to your environment, to the way you were brought up, to your genetics, that is up to you, fundamentally, to respond. The passage I brought you in source number 12 imagines a scene in which before somebody is gestated, so to speak, when the egg is first fertilized, it's brought before God. And God says whether it's going to be powerful or weak, wise or foolish, wealthy or poor, but what God does not give the verdict on is this person going to be wicked or righteous? That's up to you. It's up to you to decide how you're going to respond to all these other elements. The passage in the Talmud in source number 13 speaks to the belief in astrology, the idea that if you're born under the sign of Mars, you'll be a shedder of blood. And the sages said, you know, that can be a good thing and that can be a bad thing. It all depends on how you use it. A person can be a mole. A person can be a butcher. A person can, well, don't tell my vegetarian kids. But there are okay ways to use that trait. Leave aside belief in astrology. Source number 14, flipping the page. Maimonides writes it in his Laws of Repentance. Each person is given permission to incline himself to a good path and be righteous, or to incline himself in a bad path and be wicked. And as he writes, I didn't bring the piece here, but as he continues to say elsewhere, without it, the entire Torah is meaningless. Because how can you give instructions to people if they don't have the freedom to decide whether they're going to follow it or not? Of what meaning is an instruction given to somebody who doesn't have free will? By definition, if you're telling people you must do this and you must not do that, you have to give them the power to do it. You have to give them the power to refrain from things. Viktor Frankl wrote something about this in source number 15. We're going to talk about logotherapy, I expect, in the last week of the series. But here, I bring you just a note. One of the tenets of his system of logotherapy is that human beings have free will. And he says, I'm not going to prove it to you from psychological argument. I am not going to prove it to you from experiments. I'm not going to prove it to you from religious texts. I'm going to prove it to you from my own experience, he says. And that's what's in 15. He says, Freud said that if you take people who seem very different and you expose them to starvation, they'll all in the end react the same way. When people are hungry enough, all of their differences are blotted out. To which Frankl responds saying that the camps proved him wrong. And remember, Frankl went through the camps. And he describes what he saw in the camps. And he says, yes, it's true that there were many people who indeed all had a common reaction, and it wasn't a great reaction. However, there were a lot of people who reacted differently. exhibited, as he writes here, the virtues of saintliness. You can see the quote yourself. I'm jumping the quote in the interest of time. But the point is that he observed it, that there is such a thing as free will, and we dare not surrender it. Because if we surrender our free will, then the Judaism's basic understanding of why we're in this world, to make good on our promise of what we can do, has now been forfeited. When a person pursues addictive behavior for the sake of alleviating stress, alleviating a neurosis, dealing with a problem, right? What they're doing is they're making a trade. I'm going to trade my free will for a remedy for this problem that I'm dealing with. That's fundamentally the exchange that's being made, and that's one that Judaism is not ready to accept. Take a look, please, at source number 16, which speaks to the problem that people are trying to solve. This is one of Rabbi Tversky's famous much repeated pieces. I brought it from his book, Positive Parenting. A number of years ago, a campaign was started in the United States, Just Say No to Drugs. Research psychologists questioned young people about their attitude towards this and were surprised to find 13 and 14-year-old youngsters responding, why? Right? Just say no. Why? What else is there? It should be obvious that all preventive efforts to curb the drug epidemic will be futile unless we can provide young people with a reasonable and understandable answer to the question, why? What else is there? Right? They need to know that there's something else that they can do to satisfy their problem besides making this terrible trade of giving up your free will to look for, in return, this type of satisfaction. Okay, so we have defined addiction to a certain extent. We're focusing on the psychological addiction. We've recognized that within Judaism there is a warning about addiction, and it's presented in the most dire of terms in order to say you better treat this seriously and take it seriously in the early going. Jewish law says, no, one is not allowed to knowingly enter into a situation where they will become addicted. And in fact, that trade-off of free will in exchange for satisfaction is it's offensive to Judaism's embrace of and need for free will and freedom of choice. So what do we do? So the 12 steps approach is not Jewish inherently. I think, as I understand it, it actually started from Christian circles. But it has a lot in common with Jewish approaches to changing our behavior. And here I repeat what I said in the beginning, which is, I am not an expert. If someone is dealing with this or knows someone who's dealing with this, I recommend JAKS. I find them to be very good and knowledgeable. The first step, though, that I would note here is what I said before about Bisruo To, the rebuke, in our story. It's not working. Right? The parents are rebuking, and they're not getting anywhere. And I think that's an important point. But looking at the 12-step approach that the groups tend to use, I want to identify four elements in particular that have common aspects in Judaism. The first one is in source number 17. Steps 1, 4, and 5 out of the 12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. This is taken from an Alcoholics Anonymous website. Fill in the blank for whatever addiction you want to put in place. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We admitted to ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Common denominator between all three is what? Self-awareness. Acknowledgement of the addiction. Right? It's that someone needs to actually say, I am. That's what we're talking about. And in Jewish thought, this makes it into the process of repentance and change as repentance 101. So to speak. Maimonides records it in source number 18 in the beginning of his Laws of Repentance. He says, regarding every biblical mitzvah, commandment, as well as prohibition, when one violates any of them, whether intentionally or in error, and he performs tshuva, repentance, and returns from his sin, he is obligated to admit it before God. It is written, when a man or woman performs whatever they should not have done, they shall admit the sin they performed. This is verbal admission. What's the word for it in Hebrew? Vidui. Right? Vidui. Admission. To admit. And this verbal admission fulfills a commandment. It's actually a mitzvah for somebody to do this. What's the one big difference between what you saw in the steps in source number 17 and what Maimonides prescribes in number 18? There's one key difference. Out loud? Well, to another person. Right? In source number 17, it says we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. Right? Judaism generally doesn't have a confession procedure. Right? We don't generally do that. But there's actually a lot of debate about acknowledging one's sin to others and whether this is considered meritorious. And what it comes down to is where there's a sin one has committed against others, so it's known socially, then Maimonides says there is value to acknowledging it to others. Whereas if it's something that's been between you and God, better not to acknowledge it, because all you accomplish is to desensitize others to wrongdoing. Because, oh, well, he did it. I guess it's not so bad if other people are doing it. And it actually can have a negative effect on society. But this issue of admitting it to others, there's certainly a power to it. Why do they want you to do it in the 12 steps? What's the reason?
Well, it's like confession. It is confession.
It is confession, yeah.
Well, it's going from, it's acknowledging I have a problem. Mm-hmm. I might have a problem. You think I have a problem. I don't have a problem. I have a problem.
Right? It's an acknowledgement, and it's an acknowledgement to a living person. Someone you can see in front of you, and you can see their reaction. I think there's something more substantive to that interaction.
It's harder to go back.
That's right. You can, we can't. Right? Conversations with God, because of the one-sided nature that most of our conversations have, right? And if yours are not one-sided, you know, that's amazing. But generally speaking, the expression goes one way. There is an element of it which is kind of ephemeral. That when you're dealing with a person, this is real now. I'm going to tell a human being. Second, repairing wrongs committed in the throes of the addiction. Take a look into source number 19. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. We made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So we wanted to get it right. We wanted to repair whatever we had done wrong, and Maimonides speaks of that in source number 20. The requirement of satisfying anybody we've offended, of righting the wrongs of what we've done. I did note for you in source number 21, Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook, who wrote extensively on repentance from a mystical perspective, says in number 21, I'm going to say it outside of the text itself, but he says, your soul feels incomplete until you repair the physical wrongs that have been done. It isn't just about, in order to make the balances even, I need to correct my wrongs in order to move on. But my soul will actually feel something is not right. And I will feel what psychologists would term a neurosis until I know that I've actually corrected it. So the second element that we have in common here is the element of repairing wrongs. It's the acknowledgement, repairing wrongs. And then third, very important, is the honesty about what we're doing right now. The honesty about where we are now. Source number 22, step 4 out of the 12 steps, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Rabbi Twersky in source number 23 gives this great story. Alan, a recovering alcoholic, was oblivious to the effects of his drinking, in spite of what people said to him. Since he drank only beer, he was certain he didn't have an alcohol problem. Eventually, Alan became physically sick and could no longer deny something was wrong. He concluded that by drinking half a case of beer daily, he was consuming too much fluid. So he switched to scotch and soda. You're laughing, but don't laugh. I understand why you're laughing, but still. When the physical symptoms got worse, he faulted the soda and switched to whiskey and water. As his symptoms got even worse, he eliminated the water. Everything is the problem except the addiction. Right. It's a classic problem, but we do this. The Talmud has many statements about this. I brought one in source number 24. A person does not transgress unless a spirit of insanity, in the Hebrew, shtus, enters him. There is an element of not recognizing reality. That's why, or that's one of the reasons why counseling becomes so important. Because you need somebody outside yourself to point it out. Because we're just not in a position to recognize the justifications that we're using for this. The last of the elements in common, and this is a very big part of the 12-step approach, is the emphasis on divine help. It's controversial in the 12 steps. But take a look at number 25. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Right? God as we understood Him is a classic line in order to avoid the problem of endorsing a particular religion. But that's what they talk about, is relying on God. And in Judaism, even though we are taught, as in source number 26, and as we said before, that God gives us free will, He leaves it in our hands, we absolutely have a concept of relying on God for help, of turning to God and saying, help me. The daily Amidah, recited 3 times a day, includes a prayer in which we ask God to bring us back to repentance. God, bring me back. Well, then, is it really me? Did I really do it? The answer is yes, but we recognize that there's a need for help. And being able to say there's something outside of myself that will assist me is really important. And so it gets stressed in our literature. Those are 4 common denominators which I sped through, and I apologize for speeding through it, but I wanted to really do this topic this week and next topic. But 4 elements that are important to recognize in Judaism: acknowledging the addiction, righting the wrongs committed in its pursuit, honesty about what we're doing now, and turning to God and asking God for help. One last point that people need to recognize. This has been such a depressing hour, talking about all the problems and the addictions and everything else. But I wanted to end on an important positive note, precisely because that passage that we read from the Torah leaves you to believe, that's it, it's all over, just kill him and move on, right? That's what the passage is saying. Take a look at number 29 from Rabbi Dr. Twersky. He says, because recovery is a growth process, relapse is an interruption of that growth. But relapse does not mean going back to square one. Yet almost without exception, that's what the relapser is likely to think. After 2 years or 12 years of recovery, a person who relapses may feel back at rock bottom. This conclusion is mistaken, however, and can negatively affect recovery from a relapse. Many people who relapse think, what's the use? I've tried, it doesn't work, I might as well give up the light. They give up the fight. They think that it's over. They think that they failed and they're back at square one. And so I bring you the last quote from Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, who expressed this beautifully. He was in the yeshiva in Gateshead, England during World War II. He says, when they experiment to produce a flower with a new appearance, they sometimes plant great fields and the entire thing is ruined. But if even one flower succeeds, then they rejoice in their success. When someone who does not understand this sees it, he looks at the great amount that goes to waste and wonders to himself, what are they doing here? They lose so many plants and all the expense of raising them in order to get only one plant, and they call this success. But one who understands knows that this flower stands out for its quality and is worth all of the expenses of acquiring it, and even an expenditure of 1,000-fold more to acquire it would still be a great success. When someone is dealing with an addiction and they manage to stay off it for a day, that is the flower, and that is the success. And even if it is true that addiction can rob someone of their free will, which is what we've said, and even if it is true that it will drive them to great extremes, every step of progress that they make is valuable, and ultimately the goal obviously is for them to be able to put enough of those together to be able to break it. God willing, they should be able to. We'll continue next week, and our topic will be obsessive compulsive disorder. Oh boy. Thank you very much.